Good afternoon. We're going to get started with our Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. For our meeting today, we have a number of informational hearings. This is to give the committee an opportunity to get reports back from various work groups that have been working. We will be receiving those. I will tell you, I have one member that is out today, have another one that will be here soon, and I have another that will need to excuse herself to take care of some other matters. So what we're going to do is we're going to start at the top, if that's a good start, Bill, and that's if our groups are ready to go.
Sure.
And what we'll do is go ahead and open up a informational hearing on the work group reporting on sex offenders. And Jeff, I understand, is going to take the lead on this, and I'm not sure how many others are planning on speaking directly, but Jeff, why don't you come on up, and if you want to bring anyone with you at this point, feel free to do that, or we can call up anyone if you need that at some point in the future. And thank you for being here.
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, thank you for a moment of your time. For the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I serve as the Parole and Probation Division Commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. With me is Darcy Baker with the Oregon Department of Corrections and outgoing Vice Chair of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and Vi Beatty, who is the manager of the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registry. And we are here to present you the sum total of our work to date in regards to a sex offender registration and notification proposal. To memorialize some of the work that we've done in the past, we initially met with the assistance of legislative counsel during the summer months of 2011 to address sex offender registration and notification. Even though those two are two different subjects, they are intertwined, so to speak, and they are connected to one another, and really examine our current system and come up with any draft proposal, so to speak, in terms of what can we do that may be better than our current practices to date. As I mentioned, although I'll sort of be the talking head during this presentation, rest assured there are people much smarter than I who were a part of this committee and drafting some of these proposals that you'll hear about. I've already introduced Vi Beatty, who's the manager of the State Police. Portland Police Bureau Officer Bridget Sicken has, who coordinates the sex offender registration for the Portland Police Bureau, also contributed. Katie Gotch, who's the clinical coordinator with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, was a contributing member. I've already introduced Darcy Baker. Brenda Carney, who is in the audience, who is a lead parole and probation officer with Columbia County Community Corrections, participated. And lastly, my sheriff, Jason Myers of Marion County, who is here for, if no other reason, to keep an eye on me and make sure that I don't embarrass him.
I'll let you know if he's come up behind
you. If he's shaking his head, please let me know. Kind of understand where we're going or what we're looking at in terms of some draft proposals, I think it's very important to see where we've been and where we are as we make an eye towards the future. And so just I'll breeze through some of these PowerPoint slides. Historically speaking, the Department of Corrections began registration of supervised offenders back in 1989. And then in 1991, those registration obligations changed to a lifetime requirement. In 1999, Oregon adopted Megan's Law in reference to Megan Kanka, who was murdered by a sex offender parolee in New Jersey back in 1994. That initiated the first state police public website. Megan's Law, if you remember, allows for community notification of sex offenders moving into communities. From what Vias told me, that website was up and operational for about 24 hours until court injunctions ceased it. And then resurfaced back in 2005 with the Oregon State Police public predatory website. In terms of some of the registration facts and the, I guess, the workload issue that's associated with this, in terms of registration of adult offenders, we're looking at about 17,000 total adults who are registered as a sex offender in the state of Oregon. It breaks down to about 12,000 who aren't on supervision, about 5,000 who are. We do have a small spattering, if you will, of people, non-Oregon residents, that come into Oregon for work or school and are required to register as such. Within registration, there is a subcomponent of registration, which is deemed, you know, those predatory offenders, and I'll explain that in a moment. But roughly about 10% of the entire registration caseload has predatory sex offenders in it, so you're looking at about 10%. In addition to the workload with the people that are currently residing in Oregon, VI and her staff also have to maintain out-of-state records for state police. For out-of-state offenders, as mandated by law. Okay. If you break it down in terms of the total obligation or the total workload for registration, you're looking at about 130 people who get added to the rolls each month. And I don't intend to go down every single sex crime here, but generally speaking, in terms of registrable crimes, you're talking about crimes such as rape, sodomy, sex abuse, unlawful sexual penetration, incest, encouraging child sex abuse, amongst others. And then according to VI, as of January 1st, 2012, we will be adding animal sexual assault to the list of registrable crimes. For those crimes that I just mentioned that qualify for registration, in 1993, House Bill 2759 allowed for community notification of, quote, predatory offenders. Basically, what that means is a person who has those traits to injure or victimize others and who has specifically committed the crime of rape, sodomy, sex abuse, or unlawful sexual penetration in any degree. Is a subset of the ORS 181 law, we are obligated, or in determining whether or not somebody is a predatory sex offender, we use a risk assessment scale, that is approved by the Department of Corrections or a community corrections agency. Historically speaking, I'd say we've probably gone through four generations of sex offender risk assessments. Our initial attempt that we utilized was called the Sex Offender Risk Assessment. Then there was a later version called the Oregon Sex Offender Risk Assessment. We were very original in some of our names. We utilized these assessments back in 2000 and from 1993 to 2003. And generally speaking, if somebody, the Oregon Sex Offender Risk Assessment had a positive and negative scale. Generally speaking, if somebody scored a minus 50 or greater, or they had three asterisk items like multiple sex victims, use of force in the commission of their crime, those asterisk items can combine and culminate. If you have three of those, you would get an automatic predatory designation. In 1998, the board had, the courts issued a ruling on the Board of Parole versus Noble, and basically what that said was at the time, the Board of Parole was making these designations, and the court said you need to at least inform the offenders that they are being considered for predatory designation. And so it allowed for the offenders who are being considered to either provide information to the board for consideration before that predatory designation could be made, so to speak. And then in 2003, we had an interesting development. While we were using the SORA and the OSORA, we found out, frankly, that risk assessment tool, I believe due to the construct of it, and again, I'm not a statistician, so I can't go too in-depth into this, but that the tool itself could not be validated. Mm-hmm. And so we were sort of faced with a predicament where we either needed to come up with a new risk assessment tool for this predatory designation or, for lack of a better word, buy something off the shelf. And we came across the Static 99, which is a tool developed in Canada. And to date is the most widely used sex offender risk assessment in the world. So in 2003, we implemented the Static 9 to assist with that predatory designation. Now, to assist with the predatory designation, the board would consider people predatory if they scored a score of 4 or higher. Generally speaking, the static 99 is a 10-question sex offender risk assessment. If you scored 4 or higher, you would be considered for that predatory designation. And that went into effect until 2010 when VLY versus Board of Parole, 2005, where VLY versus Board of Parole, the courts essentially ruled that the person not only has to historically have those characteristics to injure and victimize others, but they have to be currently demonstrating those characteristics to injure or victimize others, in addition to having those crimes of conviction to qualify. And so the Board of Parole would order psychological evaluations to assist with that predatory designation process. One thing they did, and I'll get into this in a minute, that was a very shrewd move, was that they adjusted the scoring from a 4 to a 6, which basically tiered out the highest risk population of sex offenders in order to the highest risk to sexually or violently recidivate. And so that kind of tiered out that top pool and highest probability of recidivism. So in transitioning a little bit, in terms of some public information requests that do come in and come in regular, whether it's community notification or information that people want on sex offenders who are registered in the community, over the years, there's sort of been, for lack of a better word, almost a little confusion in terms of there's different criteria for different parts of registration and notification. You have predatory versus non-predatory in terms of somebody's not predatory, you can't release information that you can on somebody who is. You have registered people who are registered as sex offenders versus those people who are registered and qualify for notification. You have two different levels of information that can go out. Even with registration, it splits into whether or not somebody is on supervision versus not on supervision. And part of the issue that we've had, or some of the issues that we've seen over time, is you kind of get the all the same phenomenon. And I'll explain in terms of the predatory scoring for sex offenders, how you can mix very high risk sex offenders, people that, for lack of a better word, do go bump in the night and pose the greatest threat to the community, versus statutory offenders. And as somebody that has been in this system for working in community corrections for the last 17 years, I find myself often calling Darcy or Vi in terms of trying to seek clarification on what information can be released, what can't be released, what is the ORS says. And honestly, as a practitioner, it has been confusing to me. In terms of some of the purpose of registration notification, and these are sort of things that, you can certainly blame me for this. These are things according to Jeff, I guess, so to speak. Assuming that some of the purpose is to enhance public safety and that we are trying to provide relevant and necessary information to the community in terms of enhancing public safety, I also believe that we're trying to prevent crime by letting neighbors and neighborhoods know about potential threats to their community or sex offenders that are moving into the neighborhood. I also believe that the purpose of registration notification is also to provide police with additional information, investigatory tools, so to speak, in managing this population. One thing that I have sort of noticed in terms of registration notification, I think an unintended consequence, but it has allowed agencies such as the Marion County Sheriff's Office and other agencies to actually go into the communities and address this issue in terms of the risks that sex offenders pose and some of the false risks that sex offenders pose as well. We have a collaborative endeavor with the Salem-Keizer School District, the Salem Police Department, and our own enforcement division to provide training or education to parents of school-age children in terms of what the statistics show us in terms of what the risks are of sex offenders who are living in our community. I think that has been a benefit. And
can you go back one on the slide? And I know you're going to talk about this a little bit more, but I don't see this yet on a future slide as far as that third bullet, preventing crime by letting community residents know that sex offenders live in the neighborhoods. Do we have any metrics on that? Anything
any
we can measure? Well, I mean, it seems to me rather subjective, and the question is the amount of time and effort that we're putting in this registry, are we better protecting the public? I mean, that's the end and I know you'll get to that, and hopefully you'll weave that into your results part. But I don't see yet on, you know, how we actually measure effectiveness. Certainly we're talking about reducing rates of recidivism, but as far as actually what we're trying to do with the registry is protect the public. And so at some point in the in your presentation, I think it would be good to weave that in.
Yes. I can certainly, in terms of actual hard research evidence, I think the jury is still out in terms of, you know, what benefit that does in terms of enhancing public safety. I can say anecdotally, one of the things that we do when we do community notifications has been when we provide a flyer to the community, we certainly don't try to alarm the community that, hey, there's a sex offender moving next door to you, here's a flyer, have a nice day. We don't try to do that at all. What we do try to do is, you know, obviously when somebody is faced with this information, the first reaction, naturally, is a bit of surprise and then turns to concern. And within a lot of flyers that community corrections agencies do statewide, there is empowerment in this, and so to speak, in that the flyers that we provide to the community, you know, talk about the conditions of supervision, what their requirements are, and also have contact information if they see anything concerning, where they can report it to, you know, their supervising officer, supervising deputy. And again, we have, you know, granted anecdotal evidence, but we have had that benefit us in terms of getting the community to help us with that supervision engagement.
Thanks.
Moving on to some of our legislative concepts, and I guess I do want to say a couple things. One is, you know, we're looking at some of these concepts that the work group has been working on really is geared towards the 2013-2015 legislative session. When you're talking about sex offender registration, sex offender notification, you're talking about a lot of laws and a lot of work and a lot of rewrites. So this isn't something that you're going to be seeing in February. But what we have seen, oh, and the other thing I should mention, forgive me, is that this really does pertain exclusively to the adult offender population and not juveniles. Based on a lot of the research and national trends regarding registration notification, one of the concepts that we're looking at is a tiered level of registration and notification. And again, it's, you know, in terms of a very simplistic model, you're looking at level one would be your low-risk population, where level two would be a moderate-risk population, then level three, which, you know, for lack of a better word, could be that predatory population, your high-risk population. We think this would enhance our current practices in several ways. You know, one is we believe that this should actually include all sex crimes and not just the four sex crimes I referenced earlier, the rape, sodomy, sex abuse, unlawful sexual penetration. Part of the reason we believe this is just if you look at risk to recidivate, risk to sexually recidivate or violently recidivate, just those four crimes do not necessarily say this is the sum total of the highest risk population. It really is pertains to the entire sex offender pool, so to speak. And right now, with current law, current statute, in terms of notification, we are leaving out a very significant and eligible pool of offenders who aren't eligible for notification. It would do away with the predatory versus non-predatory language in terms of sometimes what we face with community or community concerns is the ORS definition of predatory versus the community's definition of predatory sometimes can be very conflicting. I'll personally get some calls where you'll say, is this person a predator? And it's very difficult to specify. Well, Oregon State statute explain, and this is where you get into, you know, you have to have one of these four crimes, you have to be evaluated by a sex offender risk assessment tool, and so then that kind of gets a little confusing to the callers or to the community members. A tiered system is fairly nationally recognized in terms of people understand. Level one is a lower level than level two, is a lower level than level three, and that there's a risk kind of associated with that in terms of the seriousness. Now getting into our current pool and some of our current predicament right now, within sort of the evolution of sex offender risk assessments that we've been dealing with, We've ascertained that there tends to be an overestimate of the statutory offenders. I'm going to give you an example, and with that example, please understand I'm not condoning the behavior of the individual. I'm just sort of giving an example in terms of how this can relate to the bigger picture. If someone, say a 19-year-old, meets a 16-year-old and they have a sexual engagement during a night, and the incident, if for no other reason than the victim's inability to consent, and you score that person, for sake of argument, the person gets convicted of a rape 3, and we score that using our current or at least some of the past practices with the static 99, just the mere fact that the person was under the age of 24, let's say the person is still living with his parents and he's never engaged in a relationship for 2 years or greater, the person was a stranger and non-related to the victim, that would be 4 points in and of itself on the static 99. If the person had been convicted of that rape 3, that could qualify that person. We do have a fair amount of sex offenders who fall into that category and are deemed, quote, predatory, and thus qualify for predatory notification and have been notified on. Again, I don't excuse the behavior, but if you compare somebody that assaults people or has multiple assaults on victims versus somebody who had a singular offense or maybe even more than, say, one incident but still falls under that statutory criteria, you're putting a very predatory person, for lack of a better word, versus somebody that made some very, very poor and immature decisions. And there really is little differentiation between the two types of offenders. And so we believe this tiered level system could help clarify that. For the record, with the current scoring of the static 99 going from 4 to a 6, that does prevent currently new people coming on the rolls, so to speak, or qualifying as a predatory offender. And as I already mentioned, you know, the risk assessments level system would actually expand the current population of sex offenders so that we can utilize the static 99 to ascertain who truly does pose the greatest risk to recidivate. It captures all the sex crimes as referenced in RS 181594, and it really provides some more informative information to the community, more easily understandable as opposed to referencing someone as predatory or non-predatory. And really, since 1993, it's a lot like those commercials. We've come a long way in terms there's been a gamut of research pertaining to correctional supervision of offenders or offenders in general. Some of you may be familiar with the work of Dr. Edward Lutessa with the University of Cincinnati, or Faye Taxman, I think from George Mason University in Washington, D.C. area. And we've learned a lot in terms of some of the basic concepts on what works and what doesn't. And really, with this tiered system, it really does complement Senate Bill 267. And I know you probably are all very familiar with this. Back in the 2003 legislative session, Senate Bill 267 basically mandated that certain state agencies use evidence-based practices for the delivery of services, drug and alcohol treatment, sex offender treatment, and adult recidivism prevention. And one of the things that really came from Dr. Lutessa and his colleagues at the University of Cincinnati is that risk-need-responsivity principle. When I'm talking about risk, I'm talking very simply about risk to recidivate, risk to commit a new crime in their future. We already know this person committed a crime to get on supervision or to get on the registry. We're talking about, with this risk, what are the chances of them committing a new offense to harm the community yet again? When I talk about need, oftentimes you'll hear about criminogenic need in terms of those personality characteristics, those skill deficits, those antisocial attitudes, values, and beliefs that people have that enables them to justify some of the actions that they do. And in terms of responsivity, it's kind of that one size fits all does not fit with people who are committing crimes in terms of what is the person's motivation, what is, you know, there could be some ethnicity issues that we need to deal with, can they read? And those are kind of the unique complexities of each individual in terms of, can we figure out what motivation does this person have to change? And if they are not motivated to change, that is certainly a different track than if they are motivated to change. And the reason I'm sort of bringing this up right now is in connection with our current use of sex offender risk assessments. As I said, we're using the Static 99, which is a validated and actuarial risk tool for the prediction of sexual and violent recidivism amongst male offenders. We can utilize that to determine who the appropriate people are in terms of their risk to recidivate. And then recently in late 2007, early 2008, we started implementing the Stable 2007 and Acute 2007, which assesses for those criminogenic needs and those responsivity factors for the offender. So between those three assessments, and I should say the Static, the Stable, and the Acute are all complementary tools. They're all designed to work with each other to provide a scoring system to people in the field to ascertain what that total risk factor is. In terms of some of the draft concepts that we've been looking at, if you utilizing the current tools that we have right now, one of the concepts that we're looking at is, can you break down the Static 99 to fit a tiered level of registration notification? And what we've kind of come up with is if somebody scores, say, a -3 to a 1, again, that's a very low risk to recidivate both sexually and violently, that person or persons would fall under a level 1. A level 2 could be a score of 2 to 5, and a level 3 is a score of 6+. And again, I would say the people who do score a 6+ are more likely to commit a sexual or violent offense than not. This is the highest risk of population that is currently in our community that we're currently managing. And so, I mean, we're loosely looking at a breakdown in some of those contexts. And again, in terms of, if you break it down specifically to the Static 99, one of the other concepts that we're looking at is, given those criminogenic risks and some of those acute factors in terms of the person's willingness to change, or, you know, some of those changing variables in terms of drug abuse or the people that they associate with, a person could go from, say, a higher level to a lower level, or in this context, a lower level to a higher level, if they present themselves, behaviorally speaking, through the risk assessments, warrant such a thing. And some of those examples could be if somebody had a deviant sexual preference, or they have an emotional identification with children, or they have a high level of psychopathic characteristics that have been proven to be linked to future criminal activity. And then there are cases where the person, the sex offender, does openly acknowledge that they have absolutely no idea, they have absolutely no intention of changing their behavior. They see what they do is perfectly fine. And those are some examples of somebody who could go initially score as, say, a level 2 up to a level 3. On the flip side, like I had mentioned earlier, there could be some mitigating factors that, in terms of some draft concepts that we're looking at, where if somebody has a debilitating illness, forgive me, or permanent incapacitation, that could warrant a downward scoring in terms of going from a level 3 to a level 2. I should say, just from an actuarial standpoint, with the Static 99, one concern that I think was raised is if somebody scored a 6, could be a level 3 sex offender, could they get down to a level 1? And the answer is no, that is not possible, based mostly on that inherent risk that the person poses. So it's not where somebody could go from a 3 to a 1 just from good behavior alone. Again, one of the best predictors, unfortunately, of future behavior really is past behavior, and that's part of the reason we rely on that Static 99. Using Marion County as an example, I'd like to thank my friends at the Department of Corrections for this research. If we did break down the sex offenders in Marion County currently under supervision to the Marion County Sheriff's Office, the breakdown would roughly look like this. Level 1 would be about 24%, level 2 would be about 70%, and then that level 3, that 6+ population, would be about 6%. Now, again, if you kind of go back to one of the earlier slides that I did, currently the predatory population who are registered offenders was about 10%. So what this does is it does drop it a bit, but I would say, too, that it completely eliminates out the statutory offenders and really does focus on the very highest risk to recidivate. some of the draft concepts that we're looking in terms of registration. And again, this is where some of the controversy might come in. And again, these, I want to reiterate, these are just ideas. These are drafts. And again, as we work these details, we'll fine-tune these in the future, assuming this is amenable to everybody. But for, say, level one, again, that very low-risk population, we've asked the concept, could that population be relieved of registration requirements after they've completed supervision? And by successful completion of supervision, I mean that the person has been compliant with programming or successfully completed programming, they've been passing their polygraphs, there have been no violations for a specified period of time. It's not just due to timing out, so to speak. For a level two sex offender, we've talked about relief from registration under current statute where they could seek registration after 10 years of supervision, and then say for level three, there could be the possibility of being reassigned to a lower level if a petition, say, is made, but that it would require a lifetime registration. Linking this to notification and releasing information to the public, again, some of the concepts that we've discussed have been, say, for a level one sex offender, really because of the low risk to the community, this population, really, we would be extending this information to, say, law enforcement only, or if the person was on supervision, to the to the significant others in their life, so to speak. For level two, you could have notify, law, schools, law enforcement, child care, and then say any person who's living in the residence. And then again, with people who are not on supervision, have a consistent application, regardless of whether the person is on supervision or not, a consistent release of information for people who say, just so that state police can give to somebody, or if a community member makes an affirmative action to the state police wanting to know who's living in their community, that they can release a consistent list regardless of whether the person is on or off supervision. And then level three, as I just described, that would be the predatory population. That would be those people who qualify for widespread notification, community notification, posting on the internet, on the Oregon State Police website. And again, these are very draft concepts, and I don't want to imply that these are set in stone, but these are some of the concepts that we are looking at. In terms of some of the future considerations for the 13-15 legislative session, is this concept perfect? No, of course not. When you start getting into risk assessment tools and validity and statistical probability, you're always going to have people that will fall through the cracks, so to speak. In our business, we'll kind of call, I got a guy, or I know somebody, and comes up with these scenarios that you just don't think of in terms of human interaction that quite honestly we could have missed. But in terms of, with the research that's available right now and very sound public policy, and in terms of trying to, work with the community in easily understandable terms, we think this is one of the solid options. We're also trying to realize that in this era of a great recession that we're currently in, we're trying to mitigate costs as much as we can. We're trying to look at resources that are currently available so that we're not, creating new things that would cost exorbitant amount of money. And then we also, as always, have to be conscientious of workload. With some of the risk assessments that I utilize, that I referenced, the static, the stable, and acute, for people on supervision, it is easier just because of our day-to-day caseload duties. In terms of, Vi and her staff at State Police, we still need to work out some of the logistics in terms of how could they implement this for people who aren't on supervision. As I kind of mentioned, the overwhelming population of people who are registered are not on currently supervision. And then one thing that we've discussed in terms of the static 99, although a very good and validated tool, there is populations, females, juveniles who are remanded into adult court or on adult supervision. The static 99 is not validated for, and we have some concepts that we're looking at in terms of utilizing some other assessments, but again, that would be something that we need to look at in terms of if we utilize a different assessment, how would we utilize that to make sure that it's consistent with the static, stable, and acute. When I'm referencing offender typology, this is one of the interesting things in terms of sex offenders and criminal offenders in general. by ORS statute, we naturally have a gradual increase in crime due to the severity and due to the actions of the offender. But in terms of ascertaining whether or not a person has a high likelihood of creating or committing a new sexual offense, the crime of conviction isn't really the sole thing that we look at in terms of the likelihood to commit a future offense. And so what I'm trying to say is there can be people who've committed a rape three who are very, very likely to commit a new sexual offense. There are people who've committed a rape one who really have very low risk behavior to commit a new offense. And sometimes when you go to a risk-based system utilizing validated risk assessment tools, sometimes it kind of defies the logic in terms of somebody you think would be very high risk really isn't, and vice versa. And so if you looked at some of the breakdown that the Department of Corrections research did on some of the Marion County offenders, some of those low-risk people really were on supervision for sex abuse one or a sodomy one. And conversely, some of our very high-risk offenders have been convicted of a sex abuse two or even a rape three. And so some of that may seem counterintuitive, but there are reasons for that. And again, the post-prison supervision evaluation is a caveat that when you talk about evaluating for current behaviors to victimize or injure others, again, there could be a cost associated with that, and that's one of the logistics that the work group is going to be tasked to perform. As with any legislative rewrite, I have to say, obviously, I think we have a wide or broad range of general conceptual report, but the devil is truly in the details. Once we fine-tune this, I think that's where some of the interesting conversations will be had. But that said, I kind of want to reiterate that there is a wide range of criminal justice support for this concept in terms of their support from the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, the Sex Offender Supervision Network, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I do want to reiterate that the Oregon District Attorneys Association has been present in these discussions, and I think I saw Elizabeth, and hopefully she'll nod her head. I think there is some conceptual support behind that. They did, in terms of some of the registration relief, expressed a concern, but that said, I don't think that's going to be an insurmountable hurdle that we can't get over in terms of some agreement on that. I didn't get a chance to talk to Elizabeth before this hearing, and normally I would say I think we do have some general conceptual support from the DA's Association, but didn't want to say something that wasn't completely untrue.
He's nodding.
Is she? Okay, good.
Up and down.
I'm afraid to turn around right now, so I wasn't quite sure.
He'll get you outside.
With that, and again, I know I rattled off a lot of information in a short amount of time, but that's the sum total of my my speech, and we are available for questions.
Questions, gentlemen? Well, we appreciate the update. We know that this is ongoing work, and we expect that it will continue to do so, knowing that, as you said, Jeff, these things are really not being teed up for 2012, but will be 2013. And from there forward, that you'll continue the work, and Bill Taylor will keep us advised as it's going forward. If you need any other participation from us, please let us know, and what we'll do is just bring you back in as we go further through this process of this overall interim period after the February session, and see how things are coming along, and see where we do have the consensus to move something forward, and if not, see if we can't still reach the agreements that we want to make certain we have public safety taken care of for the citizens of the state. And notification will be part of it. Senator Wesson.
Mr. Chair, do you have the capability of going back and looking at, if you were to go back, say, over the last 10 years and reclassify the registered sex offenders in the categories that you have done, that you would do, and then actually compare that to what you think the outcome would be? I mean, do you have that that capability?
Well, there's a workload issue. My name is Darcy Baker, and I work for the Department of Corrections, former vice chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and First of all, we'd have to identify the population that we're talking about, you know, as of when they were released into the community would probably be the easiest way to do that. But, you know, then looking at those individuals to see what their score is, and then figuring out, based on their score, how many might qualify under the current rule where they would have to be evaluated to determine if they're presently exhibiting characteristics showing a tendency to victimize or injure others. So, you know, we'd need to get a handle on how many, what their numbers were, and then figure out which population would be sent for an evaluation.
Yeah, Paul. What I was thinking is you're basically what you're doing is creating a model, and the better way to possibly calibrate that model would to go back and see how it would have functioned over the last 10 years had it been in place, is my point.
I see.
Thank you.
Good point. Any other questions or comments? Bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our next work group meeting is on Monday, 28th of November at 9 a.m.
Here at the Capitol?
At the Capitol, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much for being present today. Bill, the next one we have is the work group report on expansion, and I think you were going to make some comments on that.
Chair, members of the committee, I will give you an update on this. It's met. This work group has met three times. We had our last meeting last week with a smaller group from the Oregon District Attorneys Association and the Oregon Criminal Defense Bar. Representative Olson basically chaired the meeting and facilitated the meeting. If you look at the set-aside statute, which is 137.225, it was enacted in 1973. It's been amended 20 times since that time. Both the defense bar and the district attorneys find the statute very difficult to read, let alone the person who comes before the court and would like to have their record set aside. It's a high number of people that come before the court to have their record set aside come without counsel, and it makes it very difficult. What we were looking at, and this is as much an area of logic, currently it takes 3 years for certain offenses before you can have your record set aside for certain crimes, okay? And what we were looking at was basically three categories of crimes that would be able to set aside after a period of time, 3 years. A series of crimes like now that you would never set aside, for example, murder, violent rape. And then a third category, that would be crimes where the issue should probably go before a judge. We have heard in the past testimony before this committee, and I've had members from time to time who have constituents who were convicted at a young age of prostitution, or what would be commonly called statutory rape when they were 19 and had an underage girlfriend. They have been crime-free for 10, 15, 20 years, and they were unable to have their record set aside. At the same time of this meeting, we heard from the district attorneys that there's another crime out there as an example of embezzlement, where the person steals by stealth, usually a bookkeeper, and they can get their record set aside where the other people in the sex offense category cannot. And there have been more than one occasion after they've had that record set aside, they go back in the bookkeeping business and commit the crime again. And embezzlement is a very, very difficult crime to prove and to uncover. And oftentimes these people will move from one bookkeeping job to another. So that's all in the mix. Our next meeting is December 5th. Representative Olson, as I said, has been the host of this. He even brought pizza for us at the last meeting. This will probably be a 2013 issue. I know there was some hope that maybe it could be done in 2012, most likely on the House side. I just talked to Elizabeth and Gail Myers outside, and they said that both their organizations are going to need time to reflect on any proposal. But, you know, once in a while you strike gold, and if that happens, it's a possibility that we would move ahead in 2012, most likely through, with a bill through House Rules Committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
A basic update.
I appreciate that, and I agree from my work as a prosecutor. I really find that Section 137.225 very, let's say, scattered now because of the overlays that have happened. I do believe it's something that we need to and wish we could revise it, revamp it, but I also don't want to see us try to do that in a haste. It needs to be done right the first time because the amount of energy that it's going to take to actually get it done and make sure that we're addressing it. But if we could have it ready in 2012, so be it. But it seems to me, knowing the complexity of the issues and the desires that need to be taken consideration, that it will more than likely be a 2013 at best. All right. With that, then, Bill, do we just need to go down to the report on 2792?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the report in 2792 and the background checks are both by Patricia Whitfield, the Director of the Identification Services, Oregon State Police, and Major Joel Lujan of the Oregon State Police. They will be covering both issues. The,
okay.
The first report comes from House Bill 2792 from the 2011 session. Chair, members of the committee, maybe I could read the pertinent section from that bill that would give you, no later than December 31st, 2011, the Department of State Police shall submit a report to the Interim Legislative Committee related to the judiciary that describes the state of Oregon's compliance with the National Instant Criminal Background Check System Improvement Amendments Act of 2007, PL 110-180. The report must include a description of the rate at which the state of Oregon is providing the United States Attorney General records relevant to the determination of whether a person is disqualified possessing or receiving a firearm under the federal or state law.
Right. Thank you.
Patricia. Good afternoon, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section, and I apologize if I have a cough or but I have provided to you a copy of the report that was required by House Bill 2792. And while I'm reporting on behalf of the Oregon State Police, also included in the work behind this task is the Oregon Department of the Judicial Department, the Human Services Department, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And while I certainly won't read the report verbatim, I would like to go through it and highlight some of the key points. And I'm happy to answer any questions along the way, but I'm hoping that as I go through, maybe those questions will be answered.
Okay.
If that works for you. Excuse me. Again, just briefly on the background, the NICS Improvement Amendment Act, which I'll refer to as NIAA because it's a shorter term, was signed into law January 8th of 2008, and it does amend the Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act, which established the National Insta-Check System at the federal level, requiring federally licensed firearm dealers to conduct background checks through that system. The goals of the NIAA, which was enacted, which most people are familiar with as a result of the shooting that took place at Virginia Tech, and definitely highlights the firearms issue and the mental health issues. But the Amendment Act seeks to address gaps in information that are available to the NICS nationwide for prohibiting mental health adjudication commitments and other prohibiting backgrounds. There have been a number of instances or circumstances over the years that have caused the gaps in criminal history records nationwide. And I've listed some examples in the report, infrastructures that are antiquated and simply weren't built for the type of reporting or even tracking of records that the need is today. Some incompatibility with systems, non-standardization of data. Some cases, fingerprints that aren't taken, maybe in a cite and release situation where there might be a disposition that has no place to land on the criminal history because there's no fingerprint identifier to go with that. To reconcile these records, to go and locate them and make the records whole after many years is very labor-intensive and research-intensive, and it can be quite slow.
But in the process that we've been using at every step of the way, we're trying to find a way to not just report the information, but actually find a fix for the future. The guidelines and the requirements of what I use to provide the report, I will outline those, and they're on page 2 if you're following along. The Act provides following incentives for states in order to meet the goals that they've set. The first one allows that states, beginning this year, 2011, can ask for a waiver for National Criminal History Record Improvement or NCHIP grant funds if they are reporting at least 90% of the records to the U.S. Attorney. The second incentive is that it authorizes a separate grant program to be administered so that state executive and judicial agencies can establish or upgrade information automation and information technologies. And that we know as the NARIP grant. The third incentive is that the Act provides discretionary and mandatory burn grant penalties. And I've outlined those, but in essence, by the end of the end of 2012, states need to report 50% completeness or more. At the end of 2017, 70% completeness, and after 2018, 90% completeness. In accordance with the Act, Section 102, states are also required to provide to the U.S. Attorney an estimate of the records that they maintain and that are available ultimately. And Oregon has participated in those records estimates for all three consecutive years. And Oregon State Police and the Judicial Department have been the primary reporting agents for those records. And getting into the categories of what those estimates actually pertain to, 7 categories that are defined by the U.S. Attorney as records that are prohibitors for purchasing or possessing or transferring a firearm. Again, there are 7 of them, and I've outlined all of them and given some numbers, so there's some technical details and information that we might not want to go into, but I just want to outline the format in case that there were questions that might have come up for that. The numbers that we'll be referring to, the estimates from the Judicial Department, are coming from their Judicial Information Network. That's their system, our statewide case management system, of which they maintain the court records. And then the Oregon State Police records, the repository is actually the law enforcement data system, the part of our department that maintains records for law enforcement throughout the state, and one of those records includes the computerized criminal history file, of which my section maintains. So the first category is felony convictions, and directly under the title is the description, that's the definition of what those records are that are being sought after to be available to the NICS. Our goal in all of these, of course, is going to be 100% ultimately. The 2010 estimates that were provided by the Judicial Department for this category were 598,561 records, and the State Police Repository records show 592,406. And these records are for the ending December 2010 and for the 20 years prior to that. So for the purposes of this report, we're identifying that there's a variance of 6,155 records, that those are the target records that we are seeking to make those records whole as available to the NICS. So our status report for this particular report is 98.9% compliant. We also had an update as of October 17th for Oregon State Police reconciliation efforts, and we were able to obtain enough records that we are now at 99.8% for those records being available. that's the format for all of them. And I won't go into the detail unless you'd like me to. The next category, active indictments, informations, verified complaints, records that cause a little bit of difficulty in actually finding the static numbers because they aren't necessarily tracked by some of these older systems by the definition. So we are reporting that we don't know for sure what the status is in terms of hard numbers, but we believe that we're in compliance just based on the laws in Oregon. A felony, sex and drug misdemeanors are required by law to be reported to the repository. And while we have approximately 44,087 felony arrests on the criminal history, of which there is no court disposition, so we don't know what the status of those are. The fact that we have that number compared to what the courts are showing, we believe that we are compliant, and we know that those records, while they haven't been disposed of, they are available to the NICS, and so there is that flagging mechanism, and then just would require some research beyond that. The next category is wants and warrants. We're reporting 93.8% compliant based on the estimates provided. Unlawful drug use is category 4. We're reporting previously 64.3%, as of October 17th, 65.1%. Those are records that are tied to statute dealing with drugs. The work that we're doing is locating the dispositions that are missing, but again, there is a fingerprint arrest that has established the record. Those are all available to NICS, but in this particular category, we're focusing on the disposition, so we're likely higher than 65%, but we continue to work at locating those missing dispositions. The next category, mental health, which was really what was the premise for starting most of this work. We are, I've got some caveats here that I'd like to explain. The estimates for 2010, the Judicial Department reported 46,461 records compared to the state police report that was 2019 records. What we found is when the record, the process was going to be established to obtain those records and report them directly to NICS, it was originally determined that the courts had those records and they would be able to make them available, although some of them would be very difficult to obtain. The more that the work research was done, they were not able to report those. They aren't able to differentiate, so it's probably an inflated number. But working with the partner agencies and in agreement that the records that are maintained by the Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Human Services, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board would encompass those records that we would have to report. And at some point when we can get to a place in our research and with the technology changes that the courts are making, then we'll continue to do research in those records to make sure there aren't any outlying records that aren't already duplicated or need to be reported, and report those immediately. So then going back to, I'm at the top of page 6, we know that within the Department of Human Services and the Health Authority, there are about 18,000 records. Psychiatric Security Review Board has 1,500 records. And then OSP has 2,000 records. So our target, ultimately, that we're looking at is 22,000 records. Mm. 2,000 of those are currently available to the NICS via the OSP. So we're at a status of 9.2% today. We are on the completing our administrative rule process. Statute also required that we promulgate rules to collect this data and report it directly to the NICS, and has some very specific limitations on what that data would include. So we plan to have those rules published and have the records uploaded and begin processing those, submitting them on a real-time basis by January 15th. I also wanted to mention that in this process, not only will we report those records to NICS, we also want to make sure, because of the confidentiality and the issues surrounding the details, we want to make sure that those aren't just sent and left to be forgotten. So we're building in a mechanism that will actually reach out and make sure that they're validated on a regular basis, and then if there's relief that comes after or there's a status change, we'll be able to update those both at the state and the national level. The next category is protection and restraining orders. That's another category that, while we show a status of 4.6%, we believe we're actually higher than that, but it's because of the way that the records are maintained, it's difficult to separate out the actual numbers. So the Judicial Department reported 238,000 records compared to OSP having 11,000. And we learned through this, and Judicial Department reported on their estimates to the U.S. Attorney, that their records actually aren't deleted or disposed of. So it probably is more records than are actually active. And when a record is posted to the state repository, it is immediately available to the NICS. One thing that I do want to point out on that particular category, there were two projects done through the law enforcement data system, pretty much statewide training and education to bring folks into compliance, make sure that the local agencies are reporting timely and also using standards. And by the end of the project, which was this past September, the training had been rolled out, and 100% of Oregon's counties are reporting using those standardized protocols. And then the seventh category, potential misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence convictions. We are reporting that as of October 17th, we're at 83% compliant. We'll continue, as with all the others, to research those court dispositions for records that aren't already reported to the repository. And we believe that at the rate that we've been able to locate those records, if it holds true, that by the end of our current grant period, which is September 30th of 2012, we'll be at 94% in that category. So in summary, the overall rate of compliance, using the composite of those numbers, we are at 50% or greater. And if we were to look at each individual category, we see that we're actually exceeding the rate for the present time in all areas except for three. And when we get the mental health records reported by mid-January, we will be at 63% or greater compliance, and then exceeding in all areas except for two. So for the purposes of the burn grant funds, we know that we're ahead of the game. We're compliant well beyond what the guideline is. We are not, however, compliant in terms of NCHIP grant funds, which requires 90% of the reports, the records reported for this year. So in closing, State Police will continue to work very closely with the Oregon Judicial Department. We have met with them several times and exchanged suggestions and areas that we could really use their assistance in folding into the process of the e-court system, improvements that will take us into the future for reporting these kinds of records and really improving the criminal justice system record-keeping tremendously. And that concludes the summary of the report, and I really appreciate the opportunity to provide that information, and happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the cost to the state of the waiver of, you know, you say you haven't reached the level where you get a waiver of the state match. What is the cost to the state of not obtaining that waiver?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question, but I can get that for you.
Okay.
I don't believe we have applied for NTIP funds this year, for this calendar year. So maybe I didn't understand.
The question was, if you had complied with the requirements to the point where you would have been able to apply for a waiver and been granted a waiver, how much money would that have saved the state of Oregon?
I would hesitate to answer. I don't want to give you the wrong information. If it would be satisfactory, I could get that.
Sure, absolutely.
For you.
Okay, yeah, if you can get back to Bill Taylor, he'll make sure that all of us has it and it'll be part of the record. We'll make sure that's there.
I
have one
that.
Question just for clarification on these different categories. The one on the category four, which is unlawful drug use, reading through that material, it appears that we're looking at, I'm going to say crimes, misdemeanors and felonies, not violations, because it talks about arrest. And I know in a violation, someone's not quote unquote arrested, they're given a citation. I'm wondering how broad of that, because looking at the numbers, it appears it would be much greater if it included violations.
That is true, and I will look into that further. I know that the categories that are reported, again, to the repository, those are all made available, and I will look into whether if there's a difference between those.
Okay.
That's a good question.
All right.
One other question, too. Under Category 5, it says that you were to report records that are adjudicated as mentally defective or has been formally and involuntarily committed to a mental institution. Is that for a violent crime or a propensity of violent crime, or is that just for any reason?
Well, I would have to look up, I apologize for not knowing that detail. The criteria is outlined in statute, and I do need to look at that and get back to you. I apologize.
Please do so. My understanding, though, Senator Wiss said, is it would be anyone that has been civilly committed as well as someone that's been criminally or going through criminal section. So it's not just someone.
It is criminal.
It is just criminal?
I believe it's criminal. Well, let me just double check.
If you could check with that,
yeah.
Because my understanding is that the way our system on the gun checks, that's one of the databases, is whether someone has been deemed incompetent by a court in a civil process. So that'd be nice to have that clarification.
Yes. That, yes.
And you could be committed for anorexia, for
And I know that was well vetted out, and I do apologize for not having that detail for you.
Okay. Any other questions? And if we have any more from the committee members, we'll get them to you through Mr. Taylor. And if you could respond, that would be great.
I sure will.
All right. Major, did you have anything you needed to add on this one, or are we going to go into the next one?
Just for the next one.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and get started?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Lipton, and I'm the major over the Public Safety Services Bureau. And my purpose here today is to speak about the background process specific to criminal backgrounds and the hiring process. I think that the goal for some of this testimony is to identify what makes the process less burdensome. As I was preparing for this testimony, I hear the redundancy, cost, and obviously significant issues. I have to say that I'm probably going to lower your expectations today because I don't have the answers, but I'm going to paint the picture, and I think there's opportunities here as we move forward with this. So what drives the background process and why is it important? Some of the things that first of all, let me touch on what drives it or what controls it is actually federal statute and regulation, state statutes, administrative rule, and then it goes down to state policy and specific to agency policy for hiring practices, and then again, position fitness determination. What is that person going to be doing, and why is it important to request a background, and what type of background are we looking at? So some of the drivers of why we do what we do as employers is really tied real specific to the fitness determinations when we're looking at an employee or prospective employee. As we look at criminal backgrounds, due diligence and best practices really play a significant role. The statutes are permissive. You may. Based on my research, there's nothing that says that you shall. And again, because it goes down to the discretionary purpose of who you're going to hire and do you need to run a background check on a particular employee or prospective employee. The thing about it is that the criminal background check process in and of itself is not the be all of vetting an employer or prospective employee. Because we still have to look at due diligence, we still have to look at employment driver records, reference checks, because those are the things that causes the pitfalls as we look at a prospective employee. So the cost benefit really resides within our ability to reduce liability for an agency for hiring, avoiding the negligent hiring issues that come up when you don't do your due diligence, and then the risk management and the mitigation of that risk, disqualifying unacceptable employees at the front end I know as with state police, we have automatic disqualifiers for certain crimes and for sworn personnel or for the civilian personnel. So that's part of that vetting process that drives what we do and is also part of that cost benefit that we enjoy sometimes, and that it's not really that visible until something goes wrong. So what's the cost of a failed hire? There's soft costs and there are hard costs. The soft costs deal specifically with the recruiting, the training, the actual salary benefits and those kind of things. But then there's the other piece of this that is really tied, and especially when misconduct occurs. There's also a cost to the public trust. When something goes wrong, we all see it in the papers that we can only look to current events right now in the media, and it's very damaging. And then there's a productivity issue, morale and service, because it does impact workforce. So the drivers and the efficiency, again, if we don't do our due diligence and follow best practices for specific occupations or positions, we are accepting liability as an employer. Now, where are the efficiencies? I think that there's opportunities for efficiency in forms of technology. Right now, there's live scan. There's and this is for fingerprinting that is direct submit to our agency. And I'm going to ask Patricia or Mrs. Whitfield to speak on the specifics of the individual background process that we have, so you have a better understanding of what is involved on this end. The state police is a repository for criminal histories and criminal information. We're the throughput, so to speak. But I think that the simple answer today is that this is something that requires more comprehensive study, because again, there's federal regulations, state law, administrative rule, And then individual agency hiring practices and their own policies and decisions on position fitness. I will defer to Ms. Whitfield now.
Okay, the next slide is a sampling of the highest volume per agency by category that we thought we would show as just a sampling. For the last biennium, 2009-11, there were approximately 150,000 fingerprint background checks done through our office. And this slide would show that our largest contributor is the Department of Human Services, 56,000 record checks based on fingerprints. We've also shown, because there's a lot of questions about the cost, on the slide is also that particular type of record check is a $28 fee for Oregon. And then moving to the right from that, it, sort of in that box, is the number of those same records that were also sent to the FBI. So if we are not able to effect an identification or make a tie federally, then we're going to send that fingerprint card to the FBI for that national check that they have the authority to do. They charge $19.25 for an employee and $15.25 for a volunteer-type check. So in that example, there were 50,000 records that had to be sent to the FBI in order to give the national background check back to the Department of Human Services. But there were over 6,000 that we were able to effect identification within the state and not incur the cost. And we can go through that later in a couple of slides that are coming up. So we, again, just for ease, we're showing the combination of medical boards. There were 28,000 checks done. Education, 26,000, insurance division, and then followed by DPSST. Then the categories listed below those, non-state regulated qualified entities, two categories, but those are the non-state regulated entities that by statute, and there's federal law that allows them to do a background check on the folks that they're putting into positions that are working around vulnerable populations. That gives them the means, but they don't have the authority to actually receive the criminal history. They get a yes or no based on their criteria type of response. And just one more second, the total number of paid checks that they paid the fee for Oregon was 4,347, but there's also a statute that requires that the fee be waived under certain circumstances, and there were nearly half of those that fell into that category.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Wissett.
If I might ask a question, there appears to be about 133,000 checks, or just I did that in my head, it's fairly close, I think. And that seems like an awful lot of hires. I guess my question would be, are there actually that many hires, or are we making duplication? Are there the same requests being made by from the same person by different agencies?
Yeah, and that's a good question. Senator Whitten, that we don't know that at state police necessarily. That's part of the conversation, I think, with agencies. These numbers reflect just those that they did a fingerprint check on, and there are probably many, many more that they did just a name check on, because they were given the authority to do a fingerprint check, but they also have the authority, if they have the wherewithal, to have access to LEDs directly, that they can do a name check. So there might be duplication. I would imagine that there is if there's certification or licensing renewal type of instances where they need to do another check. The law requires in most cases that we destroy the fingerprint card once we are done with the check, so there's no way to recheck that without resubmitting. That would be an example. I know that we've heard, and we're still very open to some examples that we can drill into, but instances where someone is applying to work in one program and in another program, and there might be a requirement by the agencies that they conduct a separate check under different criteria. So it's, I'm sure that that's happening. I don't have a way to answer how many and to what level and what the reasons are.
Mr. Chair, that's something we might want to look into.
Let me explain. There's a great question. My understanding that, you know, we are looking at that as a legislature. I know that Representative Hovey has been looking at this, and we've talked in some great detail because some of the agencies, especially through the DHS components, they do, in fact, each of them, if they say you have a caretaker who's moving from job site one to job site two, they have to go through the check multiple times. And one of the things we're looking at is how can we actually expedite that and make it much more efficient by having a depository, a place where you would actually maintain those records for like a two-year period. And then if someone was moving from job site one to two, they would still be cleared in the sense of they would be eligible to make that shift without having an additional check, because it would still be considered a ballot check for that period of time. And they would even put in for those who didn't want those records to be maintained could opt out of that, and then they'd have to basically pay each time they were making that change. But I know the House is looking at that, and some of the discussions is that to come over, if it originates on the House side, that hopefully it would come through our committee for another check on the legal parts.
It runs out to about $4 million or something like that in checks, and we can't possibly be hiring 70,000 people.
No, you're right. And this is one of the issues I think that many of the caretakers have brought forward through the last couple of years as to the what is the need for having a new check done if I had just got one done 6 months ago. And having, is it called Wrap Back?
And we're going to talk about the Wrap Back program because that's, you're right on point.
Okay. On that. So the major, it sounds like he'll cover some more.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, the next slide is representing what we would refer to as a hit rate. So for those fingerprint cards that are sent to us and we are responding back with a criminal record of sort, well, this is not something that we traditionally track, but we did take a snapshot of September 2011 volumes, and we came at a rate of, for the type of background check, which we refer to as regulatory, that's typically the state agencies have been given the authority, and they've identified the types of applicants that they're going to be checking on. The fingerprint-based checks, Oregon HIT came back with 9.2% that we replied with some sort of criminal history for them. And then over and above that, when we needed to send it for a national check to the FBI, there were 4.3% hit rate response to those. The next category down, which we refer to as clearinghouse, is those non-state regulated entities like Boys and Girls Club that have the authority to do a check. They don't have the authority to get the criminal history and actually look at that, make their own fitness determination. We do that on their behalf. The combined between the state and the FBI hit rate that we identified for responding back to actually where we denied based on the criteria that they provided was 2.5%. And then the last category, which is referred to as an open record name-only check, Oregon law allows for any citizen to check on another person's criminal history. It is very limited to Oregon only. It is a name-based check only. But in those instances, for the Oregon hit rate, it was 13% that we were able to respond back. And, of course, they don't go through the FBI. The next series of slides are flow charts that hopefully will help identify what actually takes place at a really high level to each of the different categories that may answer some of the questions that have come up in the past about are checks the same, or are they redundant in terms of the actual technical record search. The first one is for authorized agency. Again, those state agencies are given the authority to do these checks, and they also get to look at the whole criminal history. This slide is them checking with their access to Oregon through LEDS. They're doing a law enforcement data system check. So the customer initiates the check. Again, it's name only. Arrow shows that they're hitting against the LEDS database, which actually is where our criminal history files are maintained. The result is given back to them, record or no record, and they make the determination. There's no cost other than if they were to set up a workstation, and that's minimal these days. And that's it. There are many of those that are done, I believe, in addition to those fingerprint numbers that we were talking about earlier. The next slide is the same category of agencies that have the authority. This one is actually demonstrating the Oregon and the FBI fingerprint check, and differentiating between this and the next slide is this is representative of a no record type of process. So again, on the left, the agency initiates the process. They obtain the fingerprints for the applicant. They send them to State Police ID Services for essentially the state and FBI fingerprint check. And those fingerprints can come to us either hard copy in the mail or electronically, and we have some of both. In the top part of the workflow, if there is no record found whatsoever or it's Oregon only, we have no ties to the FBI, that causes us to have to send the fingerprints to the FBI then to fulfill that request for the national check. And the yellow highlight identifies that that's where a fee is applied for the Oregon fee at that point. We pass the fingerprints electronically to the FBI. They respond back, and you notice that that is also highlighted in yellow, and that corresponds with the FBI fee, which is typically $19.25 from the previous slide. That response is going to come back to ID Services, and we'll report that back to those agencies of which they make their fitness determination or whatever their decision-making is at that point. And when we have completed that process, we destroy the fingerprints. The turnaround time average for last biennium for the electronic submissions that we get, it's 13 hours from the time we get it to the time we post back to the agency. And we try and send them back an electronically response as well whenever they're able to receive those. The hard copy submissions are a two-day turnaround. Again, that's from the point we get it in the door to the point that we send them back the response. The next slide is the same process, only it in the instances where there is a record that we are able to affect identification at the state and also know that there's a tie to the FBI because of the relationship that we have with the National Fingerprint File, we are able to affect both the state and FBI positive identification and report back both records. And we charge, notice that there's just one box, but we charge our Oregon fee only, and they don't incur the FBI charge. Once again, we're going to destroy the fingerprint card once we're complete with it and report back to the agency where they make their fitness determination. And the turnaround is the same. The next slide is, again, those non-state regulated agencies or entities that have the authority but don't get to look at the criminal history. The agency initiates the response, the process. They send us the fingerprint card. They also send with that their criteria of what they're looking for that particular applicant. And that's where the charge for this particular service is actually $52 for the state check, and that has to do with us applying what we find with their criteria and actually making that fitness determination. So following along at the top, again, if there's no record or Oregon record only found that we can't identify at the federal level, we send those prints to the FBI, so we've got those two fees then associated just like the others. The FBI is going to respond. Again, we cannot send that criminal history back to the agency, but rather we apply their criteria and provide them a yes or no type of response. And we destroy the fingerprint card. One thing that's important to note that I mentioned earlier is that there is statute that requires that the fee be waived, not only for the state, but the FBI. So in those instances, and it's roughly half or just less than that, the agencies that qualify for that don't actually pay the cost.
It's probably more relevant to the other slide. I apply for a job at a state agency. I submit my fingerprints, go through the background check, and you report back to the agency whatever's relevant for them. You destroy the card. I don't get hired there. I apply to another agency. I got to start all over again, brand new.
Yeah, in the criminal history.
Yeah. Okay, I just want
yeah,
to make,
it's
make
a
it
snapshot
clear.
In time, and even for criminal justice purposes, you know, you need to get a new one, you know, after a period of time, because it's ever-changing. But without that positive biometric means to know that's the record you're looking at, it presents a problem. So the turnaround time for those are 3 days, and they're typically hard copy at this point. The next slide is a little more complicated looking, and it is the what we would categorize as the wrap-back process. And Oregon has not really a fully vetted wrap-back process, but we do have the ability in some instances to provide a response back on activity after the initial fingerprint check was done. And I will speak to the process on this slide for Oregon, and then also know that nationally, the FBI CJIS is working on a national wrap-back process, which is quite complicated and is slated to be rolled out in 2014. And there are a lot of issues that go with that, same as within the state, but we can talk about that after I go through this if that will work. So the top part of the diagram here is the applicant, much like we talked about before. The applicant is coming in and the agency initiates the process. They take the fingerprints, send them to the state police for the check. We provide a check of the fingerprints, and in this case, if we have the authority to retain the fingerprints, we would do that and, in essence, set a flag. This is someone who is of interest that we want to have a mechanism to report back. We notify the licensing agency, or in this case, a licensing agency, and let them know what the results of the initial check was. If there's no record, we're going to establish a non-criminal or applicant entry into the criminal history file. If there is a record, then obviously we're going to report that back to them and add the applicant if that's what they want to do, or return the fingerprints back to them if they make a decision that that's not what they, they're maybe not going to make that hiring decision. So that's the top part. Then going to the bottom part, sort of the other side of the story, or what might happen later that would hopefully show the benefit of being able to have that mechanism in place, identifies the arrest process. So someone has an encounter, a police officer has an encounter with a subject, and they're going to do a check from, in essence, their patrol car. They're going to check them in at the jail, and probably another check is done. The arrest fingerprint cards are taken and sent to ID services. We will process those fingerprints, and when we do process them, we will hit against an applicant card that is sitting there with some interest to know what kind of activity took place. That person's still in a position of public trust. When that happens, a notification is sent to the arresting agency, as is the case now, would also trigger a notification to the agency that was interested in them, their applicant or their employee, and they make a determination from there. That is really simplistic sounding, high level, but that is how a fingerprint card can be used when it's maintained to show activity after the initial search is done. If that fingerprint card had been destroyed through the normal process, then, of course, the person would have a criminal history and maybe notification would be made through other means, but not through our process. So in essence, that's what is the process for a wrap back. It's actually providing subsequent information. And the key point in state and nationally, again, is when these authorized agencies have the ability to get that information, we need to make sure that they're still have the authority and are interested in that person. If the person's no longer of interest to them, then we certainly don't want that confidential information going back to them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In the when you have a fingerprint card, I believe by statute you're required within a certain time to destroy the card. But does the statute require you to destroy the information that you received as a result of running the fingerprints, that the person was cleared, that they don't have any? Because it seems to me that we can set up something that there is not required any more than every 6 months, and even though you don't have the fingerprints any longer, you would still have the clearance that if that person had been cleared within 6 months or a year, whatever is appropriate, you wouldn't have to run back through the system. So do you maintain the records of clearance, or do you destroy the whole thing?
Thank you, Senator. That's a good question. We do not keep record of that. That would be the agencies would know that. But, of course, if it was just within their own agency, they would have that information. But, no, we do destroy all of that. An element of that maybe comes into play is if the name is a different name is used, we're using the biometric to make that comparison. So while agencies do have access to do a name check, the positive means to know that's the person that you're dealing with is really through the fingerprint. So in essence, having just the name information might not be as valuable, but that didn't answer your question.
I think I can add to that question just to Chair Przanski, members of the committee, or Senator Pritwitz. I think what it goes back to is that due diligence when somebody runs an applicant and then there's a period of 6 months, let's say. I think an agency from a due diligence perspective is looking at what's happened since the last initial from the first application to a job, and now 6 months later, we can't provide that time in between, and now correct me if I'm wrong. Federal statute also regulates the sharing of that information.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But no, we do not keep the information on the applicant. It's destroyed, you know, other than for our billing purposes after that is closed.
My understanding is that the department is basically serving as the conduit to actually run the checks to get the information from the feds and back. And I think we purposely said that they weren't supposed to maintain any of these records.
Right. Right.
You get back to the agency that has asked for that. That's why I think this bigger picture that we're talking about, maybe that seemed the appropriate thing to do in the past, but now we're looking at how much this cost. And when you think about the caregiver types that are moving from place job site to job site, it becomes pretty expensive for that to occur. And maybe we do need to have some other mechanism that would, in fact, allow that information to be retained for that sole purpose with the safeguards. Mm-hmm. And
not the fingerprints, but the actual information that was garnered from those fingerprints.
Right. But the important part of this is that we have talked about this in one of our work groups, is that wrap pack is going to be essential to make certain that after the first check is done, if something should come up that they get a hit, let's say for whatever reason they get arrested, that's captured, and then that can then be tied to that individual that the original check was done, and then it can be disseminated as appropriately, confidentiality being maintained to the agencies, so they know now this person, even though they were cleared in January, they now have an arrest for, you know, something that they may have a great interest in, knowing that they're in the middle of maybe keeping books for somebody or helping people pay stuff. And as Mr. Taylor said, something like embezzlement, making certain that they realize that they need to maybe have a safeguard or safe check as to that individual. But
and the other major hole is that all the people that have been employed before the requirement for a check came through has never have never been checked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a number of things, renewals and right. those types of things that play into it. The next slide, because a question comes up occasionally, just a small survey of adjoining states and what their charges are for the various similar services. Again, those open records, the first category, which is those name public checks for usually just within your own state. Oregon charges $10 going along. Alaska is $20 for that same type of check. Washington, $10. Idaho, and so on. Clearinghouse, those non-state regulated checks, that the next two categories, employee and volunteer. Oregon charges $52, as I mentioned before. That is a higher number because it certainly is a different level of effort since we're applying and making the fitness criteria for those agencies based on their provided criteria. Alaska is $35. Washington State doesn't actually have that service that they provide, so they don't have a fee. Idaho is $10. California doesn't charge for their employee checks. I think that might not be right. That doesn't look right. I will look into that. The regulatory fingerprint checks that we've been talking about, again, those authorized state agencies, $28 compared to Alaska's $35, Washington $37, Idaho $10, and so on. These are, again, just our state fees and those other states' fees. They do not include the FBI fee.
For this next slide, this just displays the direct and indirect revenue for the program areas, ID Clearinghouse, Open Records, and Regulatory.
If I may, my name for the record is Colin Nealand. I'm the budget manager for the Department of State Police. Chair Prezanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. The reason I wanted to offer some additional information, given the conversation that has been going on during this presentation regarding the revenue decisions that are pending regarding the various background checks that we're discussing today. In the interest of full disclosure, I wanted to make sure that all the members of the committee were also aware of that there's a few layers of regarding this conversation, and those layers are regarding policy decisions that were made during the 2009 and 2011 session regarding removing general fund from identification services related to the core services. And this is about half of the employees we have within the section that provide the criminal history to law enforcement statewide. And the policy decision had been during those last two sessions to rely on the fees from these program areas to fund that activity that provides that information to law enforcement. And so just in the interest of full disclosure, one of the items that will probably need to be part of that conversation as well is the funding hydraulics that could come in if revenue from one of those fee areas goes down. There could become a need for, if we were going to maintain current service levels, for additional general fund or for fees to change in the other program areas. So I just wanted to make sure that that the members of the committee were aware of that as well as this conversation moves forward.
I appreciate that. I assume that's something we'll, let's say, look at in the future if necessary.
Sure. So in conclusion, I don't know that I've provided a lot of help here with regard to efficiency with a criminal background process, but as I said in the beginning of this presentation, there are some opportunities here that through either the wrap back program or maybe investments in technology, but I think that's going to require more comprehensive review and conversation to vet that information and what would it really take to traverse that or navigate that process. And again, right now we're tied to best practices, due diligence, and then the individual fitness determinations by agency and by the individual employer and section of the agency that's doing the hiring. And again, the cost benefit depends on the due diligence. And so there's a cost savings there that's not as transparent as maybe the savings that can be achieved elsewhere via the savings in background requests and that nature of cost. That concludes our presentation. Open to questions.
Any other questions for the panel?
Just one on the budget, Mr. Chair. You have direct expenses. You have administrative expenses. I understand that. What are your core service expense column?
That's going to be the computerized criminal history and the automated fingerprint identification system that supports public safety, police, district attorneys, courts, and provides that criminal information that we're tapping into for this process.
It's the cost of purchasing and maintaining the system?
Well, it's to operate the system, yes, sir, to provide the resources in human.
Personal services?
Yes, sir, personnel services.
What
and
are the
technology.
Direct charges?
Excuse me?
And what are the direct charges, sir?
The direct charges are the, that's going to be the actual cost of the personnel that's involved. The indirect will be the information that's provided
I think Lifeline's coming back.
Yes.
Hey, Colin.
Thank you.
So, once again, for the record, my name is Colin Nealon, Budget Manager for the Department, and Chair Prusansky, Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Woods, a member of the committees. So the direct expenses are the expenses directly associated with the employees and the cost for those employees to do the work that's in each of these programs, so regulatory clearinghouse, open records, and so forth. Core services are related to the 38 employees that we have and the costs for those, including the systems that make up, and that's the body of work that goes into maintaining the criminal history system, processing the criminal history, and really keeping the database current and making sure that information is utilized for law enforcement statewide and is also available for the fee program areas within identification services that rely on that information as well. And its core services, that is really the area that is exactly what I was mentioning a little while ago, where the policy decisions have been made, where previously that had been 100% funded by general fund. And given the difficult decisions that have needed to be made in the recent past, there have been policy decisions to remove the majority of that general fund and really rely on the revenue from these fee program areas, whether on a long-term basis or an interim basis. I think that policy question is obviously subject to change, but that has been the current policy conversation. And of course, the agency indirect expenses there that you see as well are things such as your accounting and human resources and those sort of things.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Any other questions?
Thank you all very much for coming forward today and giving us the presentation. We'll know that you'll keep us in the loop as to other developments as you continue to work this process. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
What we're going to do is I've got Representative Tomei here, and she is on an item regarding enforcing the ban on sale of tobacco to minors. So I'm going to take that one, and then we'll go right back in order, picking up next with the work group on reciprocity. I want to thank Representative Tomei for, one, being here, and, two, having the patience to be able to stand by while we finish that last presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei from House District 41, which encompasses the city of Milwaukee and parts of Southeast Portland. Thank you for hearing this important issue today. As many of you know, I've been interested in public health issues for many years, and especially health issues regarding our children. Recently, it's come to our attention that although our laws prohibit tobacco sales to persons under 18 years of age, the law is not being adequately enforced. In 2009, 27% of Oregon 11th graders who reported obtaining tobacco were able to illegally purchase tobacco from stores. In 2010, 19% of retailers in Oregon sold tobacco to minors. This is especially disturbing since in order to obtain our full federal substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant allotment, Congress requires each state reduce the rate of tobacco sales to minors to under 20%. We are dangerously close to losing that money, amounting to a cut of up to $7 million in resources. Public health doesn't have the enforcement authority or resources for surveillance, so we're looking at a different solution. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission does sting operations on retailers who sell alcohol, checking to make sure that they don't sell alcohol to minors. There is a great overlap between alcohol retailers and tobacco retailers. OLCC may be able, if directed, to step up to do tobacco stings operation also, but the OLCC legal team have determined that in order to enforce tobacco laws, they need a couple of specific adjustments to the statutes. And you will hear from them shortly about the exact details that they need. This is clearly an issue that cannot wait. The block grant money is in jeopardy, and I hope to be introducing legislation in February to give OLCC the authority it needs, and I'm looking for your feedback and support. And I'm certainly open to questions, but I have other people here who are going to be testifying on that issue.
All right. Before we go there, I just want to make a clarification. I've talked to OLCC regarding this issue, and this is something that we, I think, as a legislature, will need to make a policy that we want them to engage in this. I agree that if we're going to do this, that would be the agency that would be probably most suited to do that, since they're already dealing with it, and as you said, Representative, on the alcohol intervention and sting operations. I also, in my discussions with them, and I understand that there may be grant money that can also be coming into the state to help facilitate this operation.
That's right.
And so I think that's something we want to make sure that's on the record. But I kind of look at this as just like sin taxes. This is an area that's already being regulated in the alcohol side. And if we are going to do it, there's, I guess, why try to build a system within DHS or whoever else, where you already have people that have already been trained to do that type of work for alcohol that would easily be able to morph that into the area of tobacco.
Right. Well stated. Thank you.
Okay. Chuck, did you have something?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Chuck Tauman, and I am here as the president of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. It's a statewide advocacy group. We are down in the legislature every session trying to, our mission is to reduce the toll of tobacco, the death and destruction of tobacco, and to reduce and or eliminate the exposure of Oregon citizens to secondary tobacco smoke. I'm here today to really to try to define and elucidate the problem that is looking for the solution. Researchers who have studied youth access to tobacco recommend that several key components be included in any comprehensive youth tobacco access control program. And the elements are designating a single agency with clear responsibility for enforcement and oversight of the state tobacco access control program. Number two, provide adequate and guaranteed funding for enforcement and supporting activity. Number three, have meaningful penalties.
Number four, no preemption of local ordinances. Number five, implementation of comprehensive merchant and community education campaign. Number six, comprehensive state youth tobacco access control laws, including licensure, with a graduated fine structure or license revocation. And finally, price increases on tobacco products. We're here to talk about enforcement, and Oregon falls behind the national standards in every category of enforcement. Oregon is ranked as one of the least effective states in the nation for enforcing the ban on the sale of tobacco to minors. Oregon's reduction in youth smoking has stalled at about 16% over the past decade. Failing to enforce minimum age laws not only wastes a constructive opportunity to reduce youth smoking, but also gives the wrong message to children and to the retailers that there are no consequences for breaking Oregon laws against youth access. In 2009, nearly one in five attempts at underage sale were successful. 21.1% of high school students are current smokers by the time they leave high school, and roughly one-third of all these smokers will eventually die prematurely from smoking-caused disease. The FDA Commissioner, Margaret Hamburg, recently stated, "It should worry every parent that 20% of U.S. high school students smoke cigarettes. The President and the FDA are committed to preventing children from smoking. For many young people, that first cigarette or use of smokeless tobacco will lead to a lifetime of addiction. And for many, serious disease. More than 80% of adult smokers began smoking before they were 18 years of age. Retailers and retail enforcement are vital partners in the FDA's effort to prevent tobacco use among kids. And now we're calling for Oregon to step up and take their role as a partner in that process. The problem, as you can see, is great. The solution is at hand. And now it's up to the legislature to put the solution to the problem." Thank you.
Chuck, I'm going to have you probably come back later when we have a bill in front of us to give us the closing argument around the persuasiveness. I think today is really kind of give the committee a head, kind of a highlight of what we're looking at may potentially be coming across, understanding the urgency and need for that. My understanding is Representative Tomei will be working with judiciary on this House side, and hopefully if they can get everything together, we'll be seeing it in February.
Great.
Judith, I know that you're here. I don't know if you had anything that you wanted to add.
My name is Judith Cushing. I'm with I'm president of the Oregon Partnership. I just want to reiterate what Representative Tomei and Chuck have said, and I also want to point out that there are presently 38,000 young people smoking in Oregon, way too many. What's really at stake here is a $15 million block grant. We could stand to lose $7 million of that at a time when our state can't afford to lose any prevention dollars. But I also want to mention that in this same bill that will come before you in February is a recommendation to add two additional members to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission Commission Board, a representative from public safety and a representative from law enforcement. From public safety and public health, excuse me.
Okay.
This is not uncommon in other states and other control states, and I think certainly with the issues around tobacco used by youth and underage drinking, we need to have both public health and public safety on that commission. So I wanted to add that to the testimony today.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for the panel at this point? Thank you all very much for coming forward today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. We're going to go with the work group on reciprocity. Bill, I understand you're going to be giving the overview on this one.
Mr. Chairman, committee, yeah, that's true. We also have members of the work group in the audience,
right,
if you want to hear from them. So, Sheriff Myers, Rod Harder, Greg Miller. You participated, Major Lujan. Representative Barker participated. Representative Krieger participated. In basically, as you remember, at the end of last session, this issue was before the both judiciary committees, and you asked, and all three chairs asked me to put a work group together on this at the end of session, And we are basically have had three meetings, and we worked under certain principles, and that is that if we have, that's a policy issue up to legislature, a concealed handgun permit statute where we recognize concealed handgun permits from other state, that those permits, those people would have to meet the same requirements that a person in Oregon who has a concealed handgun permit. So that would be similar provisions to 166-291, that the state police would be able to readily identify those provisions, and we clarified through the work group that that would be looking at statute. There was a bill in the 2009 session that was given a very heavy fiscal that was exactly similar to 2415, which was from last session and we used as a model, where the misconception was that in reviewing other state laws that the state police would also have to look at ordinances. As you know, ordinances are passed by counties and cities. I don't even want to, I could guess and say we, in counties and cities, we probably have 50,000 of them in the United States, and that would be extremely onerous. Now, what we're looking for is they would just check with state statute of the states. I think there are probably a dozen or so states that have similar requirements to Oregon. And that basically is that you've demonstrated competence through a hunter's education program, an NRA program, something similar to that, that you not be convicted of a felony or other certain crimes, that you not be found guilty but for insanity, that you not be civilly committed. And those are things that they would be looking for in the other statutes. We will probably be forwarding a bill. I think it may be more on the Senate side, and it will be substantially similar to 2415 from last session. As I said, it would allow people from other states where the state requirements are substantially but not necessarily identical to Oregon's standards.
Okay. Gentlemen. Sheriff, did you want to add a few words?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jason Myers, Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here representing the Sheriff's Association today. And we have been actively participating in this work group and are supportive of the reciprocity ideas that are or concepts that are being discussed here today.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller with the Oregon Gun Owners. They have been working on a reciprocity statute for some time now, and they were more than happy to participate in the group when we came together in September. Very appreciative of the sheriff's, state police, Mr. Taylor's time, and are supportive of the concept, and are looking forward to seeing a draft for February.
Okay, great. Questions?
A couple.
Go ahead.
Just to whomever. There are several states, I believe, that do not require, have no requirements for a concealed handgun permit. So how would that, how would this work with the state of Oregon if from those states? And then also, I think Mr. Taylor may have alluded to this, but there currently there's rules that make it a lot easier for the states, the concealed handgun licensees in states adjacent to Oregon to obtain an Oregon license. Would that be continued?
You want me to take that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the provisions that you just talked about for out of state, that still would continue. Obviously, the folks that would apply would need to be doing business in Oregon and meet the statutory requirements for that. As far as the requirements for other states, what we're looking at is the state police developing a matrix, identifying what the major categories are in Oregon law, and then comparing that to the other states. So the example is, I believe, Alaska. You can just essentially go in and apply for a concealed handgun license. There's really not a formal process like we have here in Oregon with criteria. That state wouldn't match in the matrix with the criteria because they don't have the requirements that Oregon state statute does. So that matrix would be developed. It would be a yearly evaluation, and the state police by rule would develop that matrix.
I would be a little concerned that it's been my experience that the police agencies generally do not support expansion of concealed handgun licenses. And so when we have the police agencies actually doing the evaluation, making the matrix, I would wonder if it would be more appropriate to to have a at least some representation from the private sector or and the legislature on that on making that effort.
Well, this work group is working within the legislature. Myself and the two co-chairs on the House side have been involved in it, and we asked for this to be forward. We got interest groups that are involved, and the theory I think we've all come away with is that we don't believe at this point that a citizen of another state should have a lower threshold, per se, as compared to an Oregon resident, and that they should meet the same criteria that an Oregon resident would be required to meet to have that same privilege within this state, and that it would also require reciprocity for our citizens to be able to have the same reception for the states that would that do in fact qualify under ours. They would have to also recognize our citizens with their permit from Oregon in those states.
Mm-hmm. True reciprocity then?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. Not one-sided.
I picked up a different subject in my mind, but I'll talk to you about it later.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my assumption it would be done through when we discussed this in our meetings, the rule-making process through the state police, and by a comparison of other state statutes. It's going to be black and white. I mean, it's going to be the Oregon statute. It's going to be the other state statute. And it's going to be difficult to, if they look substantially similar, to say, no, they don't meet it. I assume the state police would have to come forth with valid reasons, and I'm sure people like Mr. Harder will be following this process. So,
as he is now.
Yes, yes. So I think it will come out pretty close. One thing we talked about, and you may remember that, is that through the I don't remember exactly the process they have for checking, but more and more states are getting involved in that process. So as time goes on, more and more states will be able to verify that they are similar to us as far as checking. Is that correct, Sheriff?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the database that maintains that information. That is correct. But you're right about the black and white. It's an exact comparison of what our requirements are and what the other states' requirements are. And at first blush, I think there was 12 or 13 states that were fairly identical to Oregon, and that was probably out of a 24 or so. So there's obviously some other states that have a lot less conditions than Oregon does.
Mr. Chair, I just a caution on based on Senator Witt's it. When it comes to reciprocity, Oregon's track record is abysmal, and so when you say relatively similar, that doesn't always work. And I'm talking reciprocity and licensing and everything across the board. I mean, we've had to go to extraordinary lengths to basically say that. That somebody who's militarily trained and can be an EMT in the state of Oregon. We had to pass legislation because the reciprocity didn't work. So we need to be very careful that we're doing something that, you know, and this is a standard we use. It's got to be comparable to ours. Well, comparable can be a rather vague term. So I'm hoping we get maybe a little more specificity in this.
I think we'll get there. Gentlemen, thank you very much. See, our next issue is on the sexting discussion of Senate Bill 677 and 678. Bill, you're going to lead on that, I know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. You may remember the 677 and 678 from last session. It was two bills that were put together just before last session. 678 passed from House Judiciary Committee to Rules Committee, where it remained. You have my memo on the issue. I also have attached to my memo the memos from NCSL as to the how other states are dealing with this issue. This is a national issue, a national problem. And the memo I got from NCSL, I think, kind of highlights what some of the problems are in this area, and is that they basically say advocates for change in law are saying they're necessary because some prosecutors feel they have only two options, charging the juvenile with a crime that is overly harsh penalties or entering no charge at all. Chair members of the committee, the two bills from last session and the I think both defense attorneys and the prosecutors feel that the law was, proposals were a little bit cumbersome. What they basically do, they carve out, they create a new crime for juveniles that are involved in sexting. They give discretion to judges except where the person involved was using it for extortion or was basically running a porn site. The difference between 677 and 678 is 678 gave discretion to judges where they had a 15-year-old before them and the picture taken was of a, involved was of a kid under 12. And I think one of the challenges that we face in this area, particularly when you're dealing with juvenile law, is the difficulty in trying to draft a bill that covers every factor. I mean, you could have the 12-year-old, under 12, sending the picture to the 15-year-old, and 15-year-old sends it to a bunch of friends. He's now, over a couple, 2 days, he's now eligible for 25 years in prison. Now, I'm not telling you that people are being prosecuted for this regularly. Some have been charged with it over the last 5 or 6 years. That what you have is the difficulty in applying probably the right level of resources, which is probably in the juvenile court. Juvenile courts, judges have a lot of discretion. They can tell a kid, let's give me your cell phone. They can also tell the parents that you better not give them a cell phone or I'm going to hold you in contempt. They also have the ability to separate out the idiot cases from the more serious. As we've heard in the past, and it's made the front cover of National Geographic, the new science of the teenage brain, CAT scans are now able to prove, but any parent of a teenage kid has known that they can be a bit impetuous. And this is an attempt to work through this process. I know that Representative Barker on the House side is particularly interested in this issue. I'm not going to tell you this is a 2012 issue. I think it's more appropriately a 2013.
Okay.
I did work with the district attorneys before last session with Josh Nasby. It probably wasn't enough time to put something that's readable together, but we will work on it for the 2013 session. But I think you can remember this law was passed at a time when we thought there were no cell phones. There were photocopy machines. Some people were known for taking pictures of their derriere on those photocopy machines. I was not one. I never trusted the technology.
I heard about it.
I heard about it, too, right. What can I say? I'll cut off. That's it.
I've got a member that has meetings, but I want to have her here for the next one.
Right.
So, again, these are things that we're looking at. Not all of these. Well, actually, at the end of this, we're going to go through maybe what will be Senate proposed bills for the 2012. And okay. You'll see that's not on there.
Good.
Okay. So why don't we go ahead and go into our last of the updates. And this is a discussion on Senate Bill 878 dealing with ID checks of people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to get carried away in the last one. I'm spending a lot of time working on it. And writing memos. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 878 from last session was an issue basically dealing with DPSST and OLCC as it relates to bartenders who are licensed servers of alcohol and people who are bouncers and are under crowd control. Last session it dealt with special events, and we also thought that it would clarify the issue around bartenders checking IDs not just behind the bar but at the front door of the establishment. It appears that we created some ambiguity as it relates to that issue. I have met yesterday with people from BPSST, the Restaurant Association, League of Cities, the City of Eugene in the City of Portland with the Legislative Council's office to work out a couple of drafts. Basically, what we would say is that someone who has a service license and who incidentally checks out IDs would be okay. Now, I got an email just before the meeting from DPSST saying, you know, we went back and looked at it and where people are and support them, we may not need to change the law. The Restaurant Association said, well, if that's so, why are people being cited? So we're going to try to clarify that issue. But we will have a bill that will address the issue, and who knows, by February we might not need to address the issue, but that will be explored fully.
And I appreciate that. This is one of those things that came up. It seems like there was maybe some, let's say, room for interpretation that was different than, I think, the intent that we had when it was going through. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, let's just make sure that we'll make sure the language is appropriate, does to cover it. If it doesn't, then we'll do some clarification. Vice Chair Cruz and myself have agreed that this would be one of the bills that we would be pushing forward during the 2012 to make certain that we get this issue clarified based on what we think is appropriate and doesn't seem to be risking public health.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in my conversation with the folks from Portland earlier today, I think that they think that they're close to getting kumbaya.
Yeah.
So if they do that, then all is well in the world.
So we'll just make sure that all the T's are properly crossed and the I's are dotted. So that brings us really to the last issue that we had, Bill, I believe, was just the possible committee bills.
The chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
All right, and so I believe everyone found at their desk today some proposed legislation, and I guess what I'm going to do is just the one that we just talked about is one of those. Now, Bill, the one that Senate Bill 355 on, it says cheating, reducing it to a Class A misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it will have a relating clause relating to crime.
Correct.
if we do not fill the five placeholders, rest assured that I will find sufficiently broad relating clauses that will...
Yeah. Just be very cautious and conscious. We know some different news is going to be coming regarding financial issues for this state, and we felt that it was important that we have a couple of areas that we could, if we could get a relating clause that's broad enough, if we need to have it, we have something that we could use to actually do something if it comes to that. This is more of a hope we don't have to go there in those areas, but we just need some relating clauses that could potentially allow us to have that discussion and, if necessary, take a vote on it. So that's it. There's no...
I guess, Mr. Chair, hopefully if we haven't come to resolution by January, then we drop the thing, I think, because for most substantive
cases, we're going to have
four hearings. You will have more because judiciary meets more often, but still, 2 weeks ain't much time to do much.
That's right. So on this list, you'll see that number one thing is public meetings law. For those who are not familiar, there was a decision that came out of the Lane County Circuit Court regarding county commissioners as to whether they were, let's say, violating the public meetings law. I had a LC do a review of that decision when it came out, but sat on it because I was not going to try to underdo or be perceived that we were trying to do something that might somehow impact that decision that was made by the court. Specifically, one of the areas that the decision came down and said email was a form of meeting, that serial meetings, and I, based on my discussions with LC, they do not interpret that emailing to be the same as being a meeting. And to me personally, I believe an email is the modern day letter without the stamp being put on it, as compared to having these services that are a go-to meeting where you're actually able to converse with each other simultaneously, sharing documents, etc. So that might be one of the areas that we want to clarify, because the concern is that if this decision is limited at this point because it was not appealed into Lane County, but this decision could in fact be interpreted by some other counties or other districts that could be a means of impairing the ability for local government officials to be able to have any type of, I'm going to call it distribution of information.
Communication
without actually being in a meeting. So what I will do is I will make available before the end of the year this opinion for everyone to have an opportunity to look at it. We've had two or three other people look at it, call them legal scholars in this area, and they've all agreed that they thought the decision was, let's say, maybe not in compliance with what most people, how they would have interpreted it. So my concern and my goal here is that we make certain that local officials are not going to be somehow hindered in their ability to conduct business.
Lane County, at least you know, with five commissioners, at least two of them can get together and have a conversation. In Douglas County, they can't even do that.
Right. And that's, you know, that's the thing. I mean, to me, all of us, I know, respect and expect that open meetings law to be respected. But this decision, when you look at it, it really does potentially cause people to pause whether if they send an email somehow that's going to be interpreted to be a serial meeting as this decision came out. That's the purpose of that.
There's also the issue of travel. You know, when you live in the far reaches of the state, I believe all three county commissioners in Klamath County are in Eugene
right.
They drove three vehicles because they're not allowed to travel together.
Yeah, I mean, it's
a bit of an absurdity.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that out of precaution, that's what they're doing.
Yes.
I mean, clearly they could do it, but then if anything, you know, came back and said, well, y'all are in the, you had to talk about business.
Sure.
And the reality is maybe they didn't. Maybe they talked about the upcoming games for the weekend.
Almost goes back to the I think it was the late 70s or early 80s when the Federal Trade Commission, anytime you had a conversation, you were conspiring. You know, I mean, at some point in time, you have to use some common sense.
Right.
I look forward to it.
So I will go ahead and share with the committee the other. I have two bills that I plan to be bringing forward. Let's call them the personal bills. One of them is going to be the reciprocity bill that we've heard about today. And the purpose for that is instead of doing it as a committee bill, I want to give everyone the opportunity who wants to sign on to it to be able to be a sponsor on the bill like we've done in others. And as a committee bill, it can't be done that way.
I guess that's true, isn't
it? It is true. And I felt that this is something that we might, you know, if everyone, whoever wants to get on board, if they are wanting to be a supporter of that, I think this is an opportunity and a means to do that. The other one that is the, if you remember, we had in the last hearing day, legislative week in September, we had a report regarding the military funerals and how to address that issue. Based on the information I've received and the analysis that have been done, I expect that what you'll see is a bill that's going to be dealing with for all funerals for disorderly conduct, and this will be one that will, in fact, protect all families in this state from any type of outburst in conduct and would actually have enhanced penalties for where it would be. And my analysis on that is that I believe that those men and women who risk their lives and who, in fact, given their life would say that this should be a protection for all, not just a
family. Because a lot of public figures might end up with the same sort of protest.
Or just a family down the street. I mean, why should anyone be exposed to that type of
conduct? It's a matter
that
should be dignified.
Right.
Absolutely.
Senator Wissett, you got your pencil up, so I figured maybe you were going to share.
Just thinking of the constitutional issue.
Well, that's the other thing. From my perspective, that it's much clearer and cleaner when you are not regulating content of speech or where it's directed as compared to conduct throughout. And I've shared that information with the proponent of the original bill, have offered to, we actually asked if he wanted to go that route. At that time, he did not. I did send him an email earlier this week and offered that he could join in as a co-chief sponsor if he chose to do so once he had some more chance to think about it. And this, again, will be one that we will allow anyone and everyone who wants to sign on to that bill will be able to do that. That's why it's coming in as a personal bill.
Have you got a take from ACLU yet?
I'm sorry?
Have you got a take from ACLU yet or not?
Have not, but I believe that from my perspective, even though they may have some differences of opinions on this, that I do believe that it's better than sectioning it out to one, and I expect that.
So it's you're the new person. Okay.
So if you'll make the rounds, that would be great.
Yeah. We'll see. Dan and I will see tomorrow, actually.
Yeah.
Gets by the equal protection part of it nicely.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's the speech of it. That was just, you know, that's, I'll vote for it. I'm just not sure that it'll pass the constitutional muster. Well, I should say I haven't seen it yet, but it
is. I feel most comfortable with this approach than the other. Mm-hmm. The other one to me was one that I just could not factor in under the Oregon Constitution how we would be, protected from a lawsuit that would actually require this state to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to some groups that would challenge it, be it ACLU or be it the people from Kansas that are making
their livelihood.
Yeah.
Doing this. I can't say it on the record. All right. Is there anything else that we need to go over? Thank you very much. And just for the record, just for Senator Dingfelder, we did finish before 4:30.
Okay.